What does it take to cut the budget for a nation with a $30 trillion GDP? From SDPB, today is Monday, April 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Monday Macro tackles issues of scale. Think of this. The largest expenditures in the U.S. budget are Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, national defense, and now the interest on the national debt. Can America lower the deficit without massively reworking or getting rid of one or all of these programs? And if not, how would the nation increase revenue instead? Joe Santos is here to help us do the math of macroeconomics. Then, South Dakota employers are getting tips on new federal employment rules. We'll talk with attorney Chris Hoime for some highlights on how to hire well and retain your best workers. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh, and today I'm seated in the office of Dr. Joe Santos with the Ness School of Management. Thanks so much. Monday Macro comes to you.
This is amazing. It's so good to have you here, and thanks, as always, for including me in the show.
You've got the show logo behind me on the wall. That makes me happy.
Yes, it is framed, we should note.
Framed Monday Macro. How long have we been doing this?
50-something episodes, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Most people don't make it past 10, I'm told, in the podcasting world. And we're at 50. All right. We're here on the campus of South Dakota State University in the Ness School of Business. And we're talking about how big is big.
Mm-hmm.
Scale.
Scale. And scale matters. That's right.
Scale matters. Give me an idea of why you wanted to talk about this.
Sure. So the U.S. economy is big. It is really big. And so in terms of numbers, we're looking at, say, gross domestic product, the total value of all goods and services produced, say, in a year in the U.S. economy is about $30 trillion. So that's 30 with a T, trillion. So one way, many ways to think about 30 trillion, but one way would be think about 30 million and then multiply it by a million. So it's a million, 30 millions.
Yeah.
And so the point of this is that because the economy is so large, other features of the macroeconomy are also very large. And you and I have talked about this before. And so the way we often talk about the macroeconomy, the way we describe it, is to scale all of these features. And the features, as a practical matter, show up as variables, economic variables. So, for example, personal consumption expenditures. We don't really say that personal consumption expenditures totaled $20 trillion. It's very large. It's very abstract. We'll probably say something like 69% of GDP consists of personal consumption expenditures. So because we tend sensibly to scale lots of macroeconomic variables by other macroeconomic variables, mostly GDP, when they're value measures like consumption expenditures or investment, we divide by GDP, we sort of get lost in the proportions, which, again, is perfectly sensible most of the time. Yeah. But when we start to take a look at specific accounts related to the U.S. economy, I'm thinking right now, for example, government expenditures and whether perhaps we think those are too large or too small or whatever the case may be, if we represent those measures as shares of GDP, we lose a sense of just how large these accounts are. So let me go really concretely. Government expenditures. We could say that it's something around 25% of GDP. But if we don't divide by GDP, we could say and we could recognize that it's, let's say, in fiscal year 2024, $7 trillion.
Okay.
Or, again, as I like to say, 7 million times a million, right?
Okay.
So if now you're, let's say, understandably, maybe concerned about the size of government, and you say, well, we want to reduce this, your reductions, what you do, will have to be of a corresponding magnitude. So let's think even more concretely, $7 trillion of expenditures, do we care? Well, turns out that's more than what we bring in in tax revenue. So the number a lot of folks focus on instead is the deficit, right? We say, well, look, we're in the red. And again, here we'll say the deficit is 6% of GDP. Perfectly sensible way of talking about the deficit. But if we don't divide by GDP, we have something maybe more meaningful if what we're trying to do is reduce the deficit. And that is, we realize the deficit in levels is $1.7 trillion. So now, if we want to reduce the deficit, we're going to have to come up with ways to persistently cut, not just once, but it'll have to be a base funding cut that will eliminate a deficit of $1.7 trillion. Right? So that's, again, it makes perfect sense to scale by GDP or other variables when the question deems that approach appropriate. But when we're thinking about cutting back the size of government, reducing the deficit, bringing down the debt, that's another one. We'll say it's 120% of GDP. Again, meaningful in some contexts, but the number is $36 trillion in debt. Right. So getting a sense of what I like to think of as the numerators, before you divide by GDP, having a sense of the numerators, I think, would give us a better sense of just what cutting deficits, reducing deficits, or cutting spending, or even you could think of raising taxes, what it really entails.
Yeah. Okay. So are we using real numbers here? Is the GDP really 30 trillion?
Yeah. So okay. So GDP for the United States, about, this is nominal, in other words, at current market prices, which would be appropriate in this discussion, about 30 trillion.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. So then if help us do the math in the future. So if someone said we have $7 trillion of expenditures, we would just do the math of 30.
That's right. So mostly what we would tend to do is say, in most questions, it would make sense to say, let's divide 7 by 30.
Okay.
25-ish percent for radio, right? And we'll say, you know, that's the share of government and the economy. But now if we say, you know, we want to reduce those expenditures, well, if you want to reduce those expenditures meaningfully, I don't know, by, let's say, a trillion,
right,
you have to be aware of the fact that you're starting with 7 trillion. So it's important to understand the scale. So when we, for example, let's just go right to the heart of this. When you think about understandably, admirably reducing so-called waste, fraud, and abuse,
yeah,
which no doubt exists, we have to ask, though, to what extent does it exist? Is it a billion here or a billion there? Lots of waste, fraud, and abuse measured in billions, but we need to cut 1,000 billions if we're trying to reduce government expenditures by a trillion, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I think we sort of lose sight of this. I give you a really concrete example. Again, the deficit, $1.7 trillion. What sorts of expenditures would you need to cut? Well, for example, you could knock out the entire defense budget and what we call discretionary non-defense spending. You'd have to knock that entirely out to get to reducing the deficit entirely. That's how you'd get rid of $1.7 trillion.
I'm not asking you to be political,
sure,
but, you know, ripped from the headlines, you can't just cut a bunch of federal workers and the National Endowment from the Humanities and feel like you've solved the problem.
Right, that's right.
And
being completely apolitical, that's
right.
So you may reason that that's an appropriate thing to cut. You could have arguments for doing so. The arguments could even be that you're trying to, again, let's focus on the deficit, you're trying to reduce the deficit. But again, you must recognize the scale we're dealing with here. So those sorts of programs are in very small billions at most.
Right.
And again, not to be too pedantic, but a billion's a thousandth of a trillion.
Right.
So you've got a lot of that sort of cutting to do if you're going to have a meaningful effect on something like a deficit.
Which is why politically over here in this other room where people are talking politics, because we're not, the people who are trying to save certain things are always pointing out, this is like a cup of coffee for every American. Like, this is such a small, they're always trying to give Americans a way to understand the math.
That's right.
In ways that you can understand it.
That's right. Because, again, the scale, and I keep saying, you know, everyone can be forgiven for not really conceiving of the scale. The scale is enormous. So the debt is another example of this. Right now, in those government expenditures, let's just pick two examples. You have, of course, military expenditures, $800 billion roughly. You also have expenditures that simply go to pay interest on the debt, also about $800 billion. So one of the sort of eye-poppingly large relationships here is that the federal government spends as much on discretionary military expenditures, as they call them, as it spends on simply making interest payments on its existing debt. Mm. Right? So they're just, again, scale, I think, really matters in understanding what you would have to do over time to reduce the deficit or to reduce debt and so on. The changes must be, in terms of magnitude, sort of commensurate with the scale of the economy you're dealing with. So they've got to be really, really big changes.
Yeah. Remind listeners and, you know, frankly me, the difference between debt and deficit.
Yes, great question. So one is a flow and one is a stock. And stock, we mean this term generically, not like bonds and stocks, not like that. So a flow is measured over an interval of time. Think water coming out of a faucet, hit a stopwatch once, hit it again, measure how much water came out. So that's what the deficit is. It's a flow. So across an interval of time, practically speaking, the fiscal year of the federal government, October 1st of some year to September 30th of the next year, it's how much we have spent in excess of what we brought in.
Okay.
So it's a flow. It's the water flowing into the tub. What the water in the tub at any moment in time is the debt. Okay. It's the accumulation of all of these deficits. So to put this very concretely, in the last fiscal year, 2024, we were, if you will, in the red over that interval of time, a fiscal year, by $1.7 trillion. And so that $1.7 trillion flowed into a tub of debt that was 36-ish trillion dollars. So deficits add to the debt.
Okay. How did we get here?
So,
because everybody wants to go back and blame, again, the people in the other room, they're talking politics, they have ideas on how we got here.
Yep.
Economically, how did we get here?
So, the debt, well, let's say the deficit, persistently large deficits, the sorts of things we think about today are, and I'm generalizing a bit, but largely a product of the Great Recession. So, we had deficits and we had debt prior to 2008. But in 2008 and beyond, if you take a look at the deficit and then its effect on the debt, which was to add to the debt accordingly, the numbers change dramatically. They get very large, large negative numbers. So between the financial crisis and then, of course, COVID, and then since then, we have a pattern now of really spending beyond our means persistently and by large amounts. And so this is, generally speaking, a product of the Great Recession and everything that followed. Now, this is a little wonky, but it's Monday Macro.
Yes.
Now, you say, well, okay, but didn't folks realize that deficits add to debts and, you know, this was going to come home at some point and we're going to have to deal with it? They did. But the other interesting phenomenon that followed almost immediately from the Great Recession, so we're talking like the 08 period, is that interest rates fell very, very to very low levels. All right, so who cares? Well, that means that since 08, because interest rates were so low, and so low relative, importantly, to the growth of the economy, so the economy, you know, sort of trudged along and grew after the Great Recession, but interest rates stayed near zero. You and I have talked about this in terms of mortgage rates and getting in low and, you know, what it meant and so on. So what that means is, though the deficits were adding to the debt, interest expenses on the debt were not terribly high.
Oh.
So there was a little bit of a free pass. And again, you know, one can be forgiven perhaps for getting lulled into a sense of sort of security, thinking, well, yes, we have deficits, and those do add to the debt arithmetically, but we don't have the other force of the growth in the debt, which is interest expense to the extent we might otherwise. So, you know, the U.S. Treasury, just to be very specific about this, U.S. Treasury is borrowing, you know, at near zero rates. The rate paid by the Treasury to anyone who lent to the Treasury, those rates were exceptionally low for an exceptionally long period of time. So, so a sort of natural arithmetic process of interest expense growing the existing debt, a flow building into a stock, kind of shut off for a very, very long time. It's only recently now that we're talking about rates starting to come back up, and we're talking about interest on the debt becoming large. It's only recently that we're paying more interest on the debt than we pay for the military in a particular year. But that's new. Now, some of that's military expenditures have come down, but largely it's because interest on the debt has gone up. So we got lulled, I think, into a sense that deficits would add to debt, but debt on its own would not have a sort of catalytic process because of high interest rates.
Right. But anybody who's ever been in debt, especially credit card debt, where a higher interest rate debt, knows you can't get out of it.
It's and as interest rates rise, that's right. It becomes increasingly difficult
the kitchen table to figure out how to get out of it.
That's right. And to that very good point, again, back to a little wonkery, but it turns out, and this is almost intuitive, I think, that in fact, because of what you just described, the sort of that catalytic process of debt growing just through its interest that accrues on its debt, right? This process, deficits. If you want to reduce the debt, you don't just need to reduce deficits. We would need surpluses.
Yeah.
In other words, you would need what we call a primary surplus. You would have to be in the black enough to cover for the interest expense. So all this talk about reducing the deficit, not enough. Eliminating the deficit, not enough. You'd have to actually have sustained surpluses. So tax revenues would have to exceed expenditures. Forget tax revenues would equal them, or tax revenues would kind of almost equal them because we reduce the deficit, but not entirely. None of that's enough. We need surpluses over time to bring the debt down. And so if we just think about this politically, I don't mean political party. I just mean in terms of the political economy of of appropriation processes and so on. Vote for me, I'll raise your taxes, or vote for me, I'll cut expenditures that you benefit from or never successful campaign slogan. So it's very difficult to go from $1.7 trillion, again, scale matters, in deficit to something maybe positive in the opposite, in the same direction, or in the opposite direction by the same amount.
Right. So the $30 trillion GDP, what about growth? What about increasing your income? What about growing your economy? How does that help? Does that help us get in the black?
It absolutely does. Okay. It absolutely does. And in fact, that's why we almost always divide by GDP, because we say, well, let's look at not just debt, but let's think of what Lori just said, which is really, really smart, and think, look, you can grow your way out of debt at some point. You know, if you will, debt's in the numerator, GDP's in the denominator. GDP grows enough, debt becomes inconsequential to GDP, or your mortgage becomes inconsequential to your income, right? Right. It's so you can do that. Again, it's not enough when interest rates begin to rise above the growth of the economy. It's not enough. You need to also have surpluses. So again, the intuition being interest rates grow the debt, economic growth grows GDP, and we are entering a period where interest rates are rising. And if they rise sustainably above the growth in the economy, in some sense, the numerator wins the race. Yeah. Debt grows faster than the economy.
Yeah.
And that's the environment we haven't had since the Great Recession until just a few quarters ago.
Yeah.
So again, that's the lulling. It's exactly what you're getting at. The idea that we can grow our way out of debt was empirically true because we had interest rates that were so low for so long. But now that deficit is really a problem because the debt's going to grow all by itself. And so the deficit just makes the situation worse.
So is this a train that just runs off a cliff then?
Well, it's going, again, this is where scale matters. I think it's going to require some very serious, intentional thought about the size, again, the level of government expenditures, the size, the level of deficits, to really appreciate the size or the level of the cuts that are necessary or the increases in taxes that are necessary.
Yeah.
Right? These are very, very large numbers, which means the changes probably come not so much in just eliminating a particular program, but in completely restructuring a program. So, for example, Social Security, it's $1.5 trillion every year, let's say, of government expenditures. You'd have to modify that. Not by, I would guess, eliminating Social Security and saving $1.5 trillion, but rather restructuring it, changing the rate the ceiling, income tax, the payroll tax ceiling, let's say, or paying folks benefits only later in their lives, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But you've got to modify it so that it doesn't contribute the level, the amount to the deficit that it contributes now.
Yeah.
So those are really difficult, long-term, intentional decisions.
So are there, I mean, benchmarks that we consider successful? When we look around the world, the global economy, other nations are struggling with the same thing, taxing, revenue, expenditures. What is America doing different that's putting us in this position?
Well, that's a really good question.
Or are we not different than anybody else?
I think the fact that interest rates have been so low and lower than growth and all the arithmetic of that kind of gave anyone a pass, any government that was accumulating or incurring deficits, forgive me, and accumulating debt as a result. They were better off because interest rates were so low. This is somewhat convoluted perhaps, but one challenge that we have is that we are, we sometimes call an extraordinary privilege. And so, not that it's a great thing to have a debt crisis, but that does sort of focus the mind. if your currency becomes worthless, if no one suddenly wants to engage in transactions with you and so on, that has a way of disciplining your fiscal policy. One explanation, I think, for why we tend to not maybe feel the pain as intensely as other governments might is that the dollar, and so all of the dollar-denominated debt that the U.S. Treasury issues to cover $36 trillion in debt is very much desired in the world.
Yeah.
So we have, again, the expression in macroeconomics is an extraordinary privilege. And so when you have a currency that is in such high demand, generally speaking, you can find people rather easily, relatively easily, to finance your debt. Mm-hmm. So the good news is I don't think a sovereign debt crisis for the United States government and the dollar are in the cards, all else equal. But the corollary of that is that you don't have the discipline, the fiscal discipline you might otherwise have. Because, again, folks looking at our debt rising don't necessarily think, I better get out and get into something safer. We are the something safer.
Yeah.
So the flight to quality is always in our direction. And again, it's great. All that is great. You want it to be that way if you're us. But again, a corollary is that you don't have the sort of perhaps market discipline, cruel as it may be, that other countries might have. And that's a big, long-winded answer. But I think that plays a role in part.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Retailers Association is hosting a series of employment law seminars in Rapid City, Aberdeen, and in Sioux Falls. I sat down with Chris Hoime of the Jackson Lewis Law Firm for a preview. All right, so we have this upcoming series of seminars in South Dakota, and I'm just wondering, the overall picture of the seminar, do you have these fairly often, right?
Yeah, we do them. We do the actual in-person, we call them the barnstorming tour, West River to East River, probably every couple of years we've done it. And I've been counsel for the retailers for, I think we're coming up on our 15th year. So,
what are some of the key topics that you're hoping to cover in this time around?
Yeah, we're going to cover, obviously, with the new administration, what we're seeing in employment law update, but nuts and bolts, most important, disciplinary scenarios, smart hiring, use of severance agreements, handling employee terminations, but really trying to walk our members through day-to-day challenges with hiring, discipline, heaven forbid terminations in light of the very shallow available labor pool, but just to make sure we're mitigating risk, but still cultivating what in South Dakota, the most valuable resource for these folks is that are their employees. So
you mentioned this administration. I want to go back to the previous one, because don't we have a change in employment overtime rules? Has that also been updated, or is that in flux?
We we have what we had last time, which is this proposed increase in the minimum compensation due salaried employees, but that has been stayed, and it's working its way through the appeals court. And I think the chances are high, because this happened before when President Trump was elected the first time, where ultimately they did not move forward with the increase. So
right now nothing's happening in that regard. There will be no changes because it was stayed. Okay.
That's correct. Yep.
I want to talk a little bit about smart hiring practices. What are some of the key things you need to understand before you hire?
Yeah, I think obviously in the state, we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. Therefore, available labor is hard to find, and you need to obviously hire people, but you need to be smart about it. And to be smart about it, rely on very objective criteria, experience. If education is essential to the job, make sure we're exploring that. We recommend having background checks run. But there's also, especially with small and mid-sized employers, there are questions that can be asked, and if they relate directly to the job and what the requirements are, what the hours are, what the physical requirements are, et cetera, that's fine. But if we get into areas that potentially could be discriminatory, like when did you graduate from high school, or to female applicants, do you have children? What are your daycare details, etc., that we would not ask men, for example? We need to make sure that we understand we can't go there, and preparation is key. Make sure you have questions that you've reviewed, hopefully vetted, and all of this, you need to be very uniform. We're asking everybody, regardless of sex, age, etc., we're asking them the same questions, so that when we get ready to make a decision, we're relying on the same essential criteria for everyone. And if we do that, and it really isn't that hard, but if we do that, we've minimized our risk, and more importantly than minimize risk, we've identified the best candidate for the job, which is what we're looking for. So,
Meanwhile, with the new administration looking at DEI initiatives, if you're probably a larger business, but even a smaller one, if you already have some kind of DEI program or initiative that you had implemented in the past, how should you be reviewing that now?
Yeah, great question. And usually when the attorney says great question, that means you're going to get a lawyer's answer, which is right now for private employers, because President Trump's executive order on this topic deals primarily with federal contractors and companies that receive federal subsidies. But I think it's been made very clear that this ultimately will affect or could affect private employers. And I think private employers need to have their guard up that in the enforcement agency here, the EEOC, has been really given their marching orders that they are to focus on making sure every hiring decision, whether, you know, hire, fire, promote, demote, is based on non-discriminatory terms. And hiring practices or disciplinary practices, termination practices that are inherent to protecting a certain protected class or allowing more opportunity for a certain protected class are really going to be targeted potentially, but I think probably, by the EEOC. So even private employers really need to review their DEI policy, their training, to make sure that they can satisfy the nuts and bolts question, which is, are we hiring, are we applying policy without preference for any protected class, race, age, sex, religion, whatever it may be? Because that's really what the new administration is looking for and what the EEOC will enforce. And it is a fluid situation. I would imagine down the road, the EEOC is going to issue new regulations and propose guidance on these issues. I know that the interim head of the EEOC has said, we are not going to follow the guidelines and the enforcement language from the prior administration in regard to these topics. So it really is a heads up for all employers, regardless of size, that this is an area that we'll be focused on in terms of enforcement and investigation by state and federal EEOC agencies. So,
and yet there still are protected classes.
Absolutely.
So let's tie in what you said about hiring and certain things that you should be asking uniformly, with the example of what you can ask a female about, you know, pregnancies or daycare, if you're not asking men that question. But then there's also what you just, so link those two together, because protected classes still exist in civil rights law.
You know, that's a very good question. And even with the executive orders that have been issued since the new administration came into office, they've been crystal clear that they definitely recognize protected classes. And all they want to focus on, according to their executive orders, is decisions being made, whether it's hiring, firing, promotion, demotion, whatever it is, without preference or favoritism to a protected class. So the same rules apply. If I'm a female and I'm getting asked questions in the hiring process that men are not being asked, certainly you can make an allegation that that's discriminatory, because females in this hypothetical scenario that happens quite regularly in the real world are being targeted, or preferences arguably being given to males. So yes, in a short answer, yes, protected classes still exist, and the EEOC is charged with enforcing our EEO laws in regard to non-discrimination against any protected class.
Yeah. I just want to pause and remind our listeners that we're having this conversation for educational purposes. This is not specific legal advice for your business. We're going to put the links up to all the seminars where you can get, you know, contact with people who are going to, like Chris Hoimy, who are going to give you that information in an appropriate setting. But for educational purposes, it's pretty interesting. How important is communication, documenting communication? We keep hearing the word merit-based, which always makes me think about performance reviews. What's a good performance review that will continue, again, from a risk management standpoint? Nobody's trying to just cover their, cover themselves, but they want good practices, but then they also want risk management. How do I communicate with my employees how well they are doing?
That's such a good question. And so you really have two tracks. Obviously, the most important track is, in a performance review scenario, is one, do them at least annually. Make sure that we as supervisors that are reviewing the subordinate employee, make sure that we're spending a lot of time in reviewing the performance of the employee over whatever period the review is for, a year, 6 months, 3 months, whatever it is, that we put time into it. That when we tell the employee, hey, it's time for your performance review, we actually have it on the date that we said and the time, that we spend a good bit, at, you know, 30 to 45 minutes to an hour to discuss performance, and that we review it objectively. Hopefully, we're looking at production numbers, we're looking at attendance numbers, we're looking at quantified performance that we can measure against anyone else. And the temptation for many supervisors, other than not putting time into it and be accountable for it, as we try to cultivate what the most valuable resource for our South Dakota employers are, and that's our employees, is to make sure that we're giving them accurate immediate feedback on what they're doing right and offer praise for that, but what needs to be worked on, because we want to make sure we're correcting performance obstacles and issues that may exist, because we want folks to improve. We want them to be long-term, loyal, productive employees for us. And if we don't correct performance, then you really run into two issues. One, you have an employee who thinks they are great, done a great job, and they haven't gotten any negative feedback. You run into passive-aggressive scenarios, like I analogize it to parents, where, hey, everything's great, everything's great, everything's great. Oh, you're grounded. I can't believe you did this. Didn't discuss it before. Same thing happens in the employment relationship. We want to make sure that our folks know exactly plus and minus what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, makes them more productive. And obviously, heaven forbid, we get in a performance improvement situation, a disciplinary situation. You don't want the employee to be able to say, nobody told me, how was I able to correct anything when my boss spent 5 minutes with me on my review and said, hey, you're doing great. You know, if there's anything wrong, I'll tell you, and don't say anything. That creates risk. And obviously I'm giving a long answer here, but the risk side is, if I'm over the age of 40 and protected by the age discrimination laws, for example, and my boss tells me everything's fine, and then I get fired without a lot of notice or warning or being written up and all that, I can say, hey, look, here's some young folks that were doing the same thing I was doing. They didn't get fired. My handbook says, because many employers have handbooks that say, we'll follow progressive discipline, we'll give you notice and warning, as they should. I can say, all I know is nobody gave me notice. I got fired. I think it was because of my age. And in that hypothetical scenario, there is risk there, because we didn't do what we said we would do. And without documentation, without following our rules, you have risk of a age discrimination claim there. But set that aside. The most important thing is taking this valuable resource,
right. Yeah.
And making sure they're getting the signals plus and minus on what they have done well, what they can do better, so that we have a long-term productive employment relationship. How about that for a concise answer?
No,
sorry about that.
That was a wonderful answer. I like how you circled back to, once again, it's about that long-term, treating your employees well and keeping that resource going to keep your business going. For South Dakota businesses who work with a lot of temporary visas, are they going to see delays in getting their employees here? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, good question. Again, my specific area of expertise is not immigration, but I can tell you in general terms, between enforcement of the laws we have, we're going to see significantly more enforcement. I think we are going to see delays. I think we're going to see greater scrutiny of foreign workers. We're going to see a more detailed review of the visa process. So, we just gave the disclaimer, but I think common sense would say it's going to be a slower, more scrutinized process than it has been in the past.
Yeah. On that same topic, acknowledging that you're not an immigration attorney, are there best hiring practices to make sure that you are not running afoul of immigration law? How do I know that the people applying here did not break the law to get here? And what's my responsibility as an employer?
Yeah, and there is significant responsibility. I think everyone should audit their I-9 processes, getting the secondary identification that is necessary to confirm someone actually is legally available to work in our country through the process. I recommend, without being self-serving, because there's a lot of good lawyers out there, et cetera, but make sure that your hiring practices as it pertains to our requirements, our immigration requirements, our visa requirements, our I-9 requirements, that we're reviewing those and we're getting counsel on those, because the price of poker, the risk here, obviously, with the significantly more aggressive enforcement that we're going to see And we are seeing right now, folks need to be prepared, and whether you're a small employer or a large employer. So
if I'm employing people who, it turns out, don't have all the right boxes checked, am I at risk for punishment?
You may be. How do you like that lawyer answer? Depending on if you've done everything that you are required to do to check. Now, if somebody is lying, if somebody has forged their identification, et cetera, that you couldn't have identified in your normal course, you should have very low risk. But if you have been lax in the review process, your onboarding process, your I-9 process, you could have exposure. So again, in terms of priorities, I tell our South Dakota retailer members, and there's about 4,000 plus across the state, this is a priority area that many times owners are like, this is not something I really have prioritized before. I got other fish to fry, if you will, but now that you really need to focus on it.
Yeah, I need workers. I need them to show up on time. I need them to do their job on the farm, in the kitchen, on the construction site. I don't necessarily have time to deal with all this too. And you say you should be dealing.
I say I'm empathetic, but you still have to do it. And so, and I say it nicely with a smile on my face, but the message is clear that, if you don't do it, you're putting your business at risk.
Yeah. Is what is my obligation if I have a business and I have an encounter with ICE or law enforcement? Yeah. What do I mean, that could be for somebody who has a warrant, you know, for a full American citizen who was born here too. But how do I deal with, do I have my people carry their credentials with them? Do I carry them? What can ICE interrupt my job site and slow down my production to check these things? How often can they do that? Help us give, again, we're not giving individual legal advice, but for educational purposes, how are we to handle or think about some of those challenges that people are frankly worried about right now?
Yeah, and I understand that, and I hear it a lot, as I'm sure you do, across South Dakota. And again, my area of practice is not narrowed to immigration. Now, having said that, common sense would say I want my employees to carry credentials. If ICE does show up, you have a right as employers to seek counsel, and you should, to guide you through that process. And obviously, if it's ICE with a warrant, you want to obviously respect legal authority, and just like you would if you were pulled over by a highway patrolman on I-90, but you also, I would recommend, get legal counsel so that you are properly represented by someone who regularly practices in the area, because it can be high exposure, and you want to make sure that you've done everything you can to protect your business. You know, a smile and a wink and, you know, don't worry about it type of scenario now it has changed just due to the detailed focus scrutiny that the new administration is putting on these issues. So,
We're going to put some links up on our website to the seminars across the state, the barnstorming tour. One more question, which is employee expectations. You know, you mentioned it's the workforce is, our unemployment numbers are very small. People are coming and they want to negotiate with you. I want a higher pay. I want to work from home. I'm going to come with a little bit of leverage if I'm applying to a job. What are some of the best practices for handling a negotiation with a new hire or current employees who you would like to retain?
Yeah, and the last word you used, retain and retention, are just critical to our South Dakota employers. Now, does that mean we have to automatically pay everybody a lot more, provide, you know, additional benefits? I hear this a lot from our membership is, you know, how do I gauge all this? And I think market studies, I think find out what folks are getting paid in your particular geographic area in South Dakota, what's the benefit package? But the bottom line is you may need to increase compensation and benefits. But it's always interesting to me is that when surveys are done as to what is most important to current and applicants who are applying for a job, it's not necessarily money. It may be culture. It may be the ability to have a flexible schedule. It may be, remote work, whatever it is. But look at all those variables. And I'm glad you brought this up in this context again, because what I still hear, and I've been around a while, that doesn't mean anything other than I've been around a while, but so many, whether it's South Dakota, Nebraska, North Dakota, where I spend a lot of time practicing, I still get owners of businesses and CEOs of businesses saying, well, if this employee doesn't work out, I'll just fire him or her and go get another one. And when you look at the available labor pool, which is very shallow, it's hard to find good applicants. When you look at the time and expense that you've already devoted to your current employees for training, for increase in compensation, the value of that current employee is, in my book, generally always worth trying to correct performance. If it means we're going to have to give people incremental raises, maybe that's something you need to look at. If it's culture issues, you need to address that. One nuts and bolts issue example is make sure that if we hire someone, we really want that person, they want a little bit more money to do whatever job. If you give them more compensation or give them better benefits and they come in and they're making more money or getting better benefits than people who are already there doing the same job, you've created problems that you didn't anticipate, and suddenly you're having to address, whether it's financial, cultural, whatever, that maybe you didn't think about down the road. So again, all pretty practical, but this is what we're looking forward to next week when we meet with our membership across the state. And when I do this, and I've represented the retailers for, I think, close to 15 years, I just love the in-person. COVID was not good. You're trying to do these remotely, but people have actual questions, and I can talk till I'm blue in the face about legal cases and regulations, but we want real life scenarios so that they can see, okay, that's common sense. That's what I need to do and follow. So we have a lot of question interaction. We have a lot of let's work through this and a lot of questions. So hopefully, like always, we have a great turnout and really an opportunity that I love to meet with our membership. And if you're not a member, I think they are charging if you're not a member, but come by and I'd love to meet y'all. So yeah. without getting too aggressive on pitching it, I am looking forward to next week. All right.
That's Attorney Chris Hoime. The employment law seminars for the South Dakota Retailers Association are April 8th in Rapid City, April 9th in Aberdeen, and April 10th in Sioux Falls. You can find more on the South Dakota Retailers Association website. We'll put some links up on our website after the show. That's sdpb.org/news. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It's produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.